Okay, welcome into another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Sherry Coolidge, my co-host and pal, Silent Phil, executive producer. We're all here. We're back.
Thanksgiving week edition.
It's Thanksgiving week edition, a big edition. We have two guests today. In our usual guest segment, we have Kurt Reiber, CEO and president of the Free Store Food Bank. Always a busy time of year for the Free Store, and we're looking forward to having Kurt in to talk about that and tell stories about the work that the Free Store does. Just awesome work, and so really looking forward to having him.
Stole him away for just a minute, but he said it's not just Thanksgiving week, that this is the biggest time of year for awareness. And so, like, he really wants to get the message out. And so, like, going into Christmas, too, this is not a one-day thing.
Absolutely.
And so that's why, you know, it's nice of him to come in.
It's cliche, but hunger is a issue for so many folks, unfortunately, all year round, not just on Thanksgiving and Christmas time. And so, looking forward to having him, and he's going to share about where people can get involved and they can help. And we also, switching gears, also here in our first segment, we have our longtime friend, our former teammate. We'll call him, he's always our teammate. He's not former. He is our current teammate. He is on the hot seat right now, wearing a hoodie of his beloved Chicago White Sox. We don't have video, so you can't see that. He is none other than Mark Kernute. Mark, how are you, son?
Good, Jason. Good, Sherry. How are you?
It's just like the old days. Well, wow.
My good friend, we help yours, Mark Kernute.
And Silent Phil.
Mark, you left the Inquirer back in this late summer, right?
August.
Yep. And you've gone on and you'd already had this in the, you'd already been working on this for a long time. And that's your new book, Across the Color Line. Reporting 25 years in Black Cincinnati. Newly released.
Correct.
This moment, right?
Correct. We had the first couple of cases for books by the banks last month in October. And we did another event. I was fortunate enough to be the keynote speaker for the Community Action Agency luncheon. And we did another sale there that did really well. And so we're going to be at Joseph Beth on January 23rd at 7 p.m. in Norwood for the official book signing.
You know, and we know you so well. I didn't even think to, give the introduction that Mark was the Inquirer's longtime race relations reporter. At one point in your career here, you also covered the Bengals. Your true passion really is what is in this book, and that is covering the issue of race and race relations.
And
racial justice, social justice, not just here in Cincinnati, but wherever those stories are. And you've done national stories on this issue as well. You've now gone on to, before we jump to the book, you left the Inquirer to become an instructor professor at Miami University, your alma mater, and tell us what you're teaching there, and how it's going.
Well, thank you. It's I miss you guys, and I'm your biggest fan and subscriber, and I love reading you guys, and I'm really, really proud of you guys, the fight you keep fighting. So I just want to say that publicly, the separation here was not hostile or forced. It was really kind of just an evolution for me.
Totally.
So I had been an adjunct instructor at Miami in both journalism and then the Department of Sociology and Gerontology. So I am now a visiting instructor of social justice studies. We have a major in SJS in our department. And so I teach a full-time course schedule of three classes a semester. And right now I'm teaching a section of Introduction to Social Justice Studies, and I have almost 80 students in that from across campus. And then I teach two advanced courses, one on empowerment, which has a service learning component, and then the other one is kind of a vocational-based course for sociology and social justice majors, where we use Martin Luther King's final book, Where Do We Go From Here?, as our text, and have up a number of visitors. We've had Mona Jenkins from the Homeless Coalition. We have Justine Harrison from JFS, Job and Family Services, who's a social worker that I worked with on some heroin stories. We've had attorneys.
Tyra came to visit you.
Tyra Patterson. She came into the intro class in a section we do on restorative justice. And she brought up another returning citizen with her, a man that had been incarcerated for more than 20 years. And that was really quite powerful to see the interaction with the students. So, you know, in addition to using the text and course materials and class discussions, I'm able to incorporate many of my sources and people I've written about. And, you know, you try not to wear them out, but they do enjoy coming up to campus. And then starting in January, which we call the J term, which is the last 3 weeks of our 6 week break, I will be overseeing a immersion program, a service learning program for 8 of our students here at our Over the Rhine Center at 13th and Vine at Buddy's Place. Mm-hmm. So we've been working with our community partners to place our students, and that's taken a lot of time, but we're really looking forward to that and hopefully, you know, leverage that into some more funding to grow the program.
Tell us about this Over the Rhine, you know, placemaking. It's pretty telling of like bringing students to where they need to be and not just in the classroom.
Right. Well, we've had a former professor of mine who's now deceased, Tom Dutton, was an architecture professor. That was my major my first year. And then Tom had worked with Buddy Gray and the Over the Rhine People's Movement in Miami. And I don't have an exact year. I think it may have been about 10, 15 years ago, began a residency program that was based out of the architecture school that has now incorporated some of the people in education. We have an urban cohort where we have majors from all over the school, the university that are doing placement in Cincinnati Public, and they can be from any major. So it's not just education majors, although that's primarily great. It. So what we've done is working alongside both the residential program and the urban cohort program, we've created this third leg, since we do have a justice major, to get our students into agencies that are doing justice work. For example, 2 of my students will be at the Immigrant and Refugee Law Center in East Price Hill at Roberts Academy. And one of those students is a young woman who is a DACA recipient, who will be working, you know, with people from Central America. She's from Mexico originally. We have a young woman who will be working with David Singleton's people at the Ohio Justice and Policy Center with returning citizens. We have another student who will be at Our Daily Bread with Georgine Getty. 2 more students will be out at Community Action Agency in Bond Hill. So we're expanding our base of agencies in which to have our students get meaningful work. I had a young woman this semester who worked at Community Action Agency in a Head Start classroom and had a really powerful learning experience. So it's really just trying to connect the 2 worlds that I've been in. And I really appreciate the support that I get from my chair, Steve Lippman, and my colleagues up there. It's a different kind of world than what we're used to here, but there's the same type of support and teamwork.
But what you're doing is really a nice natural transition for you from the work that you did here for so many years. And like I said at my column the other day, that there's no more passionate a journalist that I've ever worked around in 20 years in this business than you.
I miss you popping up over the partition
and dedicated,
you know, with some commentary about, you know, things I might be writing about,
and just dedicated to this, to these topics and this subject. I'm really excited and happy for you as you've gone into teaching, and there's really a nice transition there for you to go from covering race relations and social issues to now teaching it. And tell us about Across the Color Line. It is a collection of the work that you've did here over 25 years here at the Cincinnati Inquirer, Cincinnati.com. And tell us what went into this and why you did it.
I'll try to be brief, which is difficult. Back when I was at the Urban League, you know, I had the short stint at the Urban League that was health related, when I took the buyout at the end of 14, and I had done was the editor and ghostwriter, for much of the State of Black Cincinnati report that the Urban League put out in 2015. And, you know, Donna Jones Baker has always been a great source and a wonderful supporter and really handed me the keys to that project, which was significant. And I had actually had contact from an acquisitions editor at Ohio University Press who had the idea of turning that report into a narrative, some sort of contemporary history of Black Cincinnati. And so I actually started working on that while I was at the Urban League and thinking how I would expand, you know, what was a pretty, I won't say static, but a very academic report on conditions. And I know, Sherry, you did the story when the Urban League released that report. And as I looked into it and how I would structure it, I started to think, well, I did that story back in 1993. I did that story in 1997. I did a story on health, a big major story on health disparities in 2013. I also did a story on the difference in lifespan for peoples of color compared to the larger community back in 2014. So I started to think maybe I'd already done a lot of this. So I pitched it to a couple of local for-profit presses, and then I was turned down. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, I had been referred to University of Cincinnati Press, and I didn't know, but the acquisitions editor, which is a brand new publisher, had been referred to me to see if I knew of people who had ideas. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, and I had a whole proposal ready to show him, and we met, and nice. They liked it. And so really what I did, Jason and Sherry, was I looked back over the 25 years that I had been here, and two major issues. One was trying to find the arc of a narrative within the works I had already done. And so there's about 80, 81 stories in there over that 25-year span. And then the other challenge, once I was kind of simultaneously working on that, was how to set it up with an introduction. And I ended up writing an 11,000-word introduction, which is called Into the Marvelous Light, which is a line from a Black spiritual, a song that is sang at my church, Church of the Resurrection in Bond Hill. And so really, the thesis of the introduction that I needed to come up with to set up and hopefully give the stories additional meaning and context was that when I was kind of going, as you know, I'm a stage 3 colorectal cancer survivor, and all of these things fit together. But over time, work in the community, work among African Americans, and writing these stories, whether they were news stories, issue stories, feature stories, profiles, you know, neighborhood stories, et cetera. You know, Sherry, the one when we were working on the soccer stadium, the history of the West End is in there. And, you know, it's really kind of neat to sit here with the two of you because I worked with you so much on a lot of these things. And what the kind of the thesis statement of the introduction is now is how something that started in 1993 when I first got to Cincinnati and had the opportunity to do a series on race relations that we titled A Polite Silence, is how an academic and intellectual interest became deeply personal, and how my immersion in the community showed me so many things and taught me so much. And really it became, you know, my mindset really changed and how this became so personal. And then as I was recovering, I had been declared cancer free at the end of 2014. And then I write in the book how what nobody warns you about as a cancer survivor is the emotional after effects, the emotional backlash you kind of get. Mm-hmm. And so I was diagnosed with PTSD, and I started having images and flashbacks of some of the components of my treatment, whether it was a cold needle in the back of my hand or the taste of chemo, metal taste of hot metal on my tongue from the chemo. Again, and this isn't a complaint, but I ended up kind of being drawn to the Church of the Resurrection, you know, which is a Catholic parish in Bond Hill, and it was bigger than me in how really the breakthrough occurred there, where I broke down, where, and that's what the story opens as, is the Sunday after Easter in April of 2015, where there were some hymns that were being sung, and I just couldn't stop weeping. And all the stress and anguish and fear, I was in a place where I felt very safe. And I am just eternally grateful to the people at Resurrection, because people I didn't even know, primarily African-American women, just three or four of them flocked to me that morning and comforted me and told me everything was going to be okay. And that sets up the entire book, is this became deeply personal. And then the last story is the advance obit that we had done and then updated when Marion Spencer died this past summer.
I remember every word of that. Amazing.
Is there of the 80 stories in the book, and, you know, and you and I and Cherry, we've all talked about the stories you've worked on, in some cases worked together on those. The one story that always stands out to me that you've done was the work you did on Avondale. And is that in there? And B, well, A, is that in there? I assume that is in the book.
Chapter 3, Avondale.
Yes, yeah.
And
it's on the cover.
I always think of that iconic photo on the cover of that page that day.
Of Ozzy.
Of Ozzy. It was a great photo. Ozzy Davis, who is
the mayor of Avondale.
Great work of Avondale.
Yeah. He, in fact, he and I are in constant conversation. So he has got his book on order, and he is in the acknowledgments. Ozzy has been, you know, a remarkable source and friend as well. But yeah, thank you. That's in there.
I got off track there, but is there one story that you love the most, or that means the most to you, or that is, you know, a favorite that you've put in this collection?
Thank you. May I answer with two?
Sure.
Well, the first I had forgotten. A lot of these I remembered, obviously, and I knew where to look, and I had a rough idea. So basically, I went through DC, which is you and I, the three of us know, and Silent Phil knows, that's our electronic library.
You know what? And I totally believe there's things you don't remember. Like, people will call me about something, and I'll look, and I'll be like, did I write that? When was that?
Well, the one I had forgotten about, so another chapter in the book was, I had written a number of stories about African-Americans in the military. And in 2000, and this was before I went to cover the Bengals, I had, during April of 2000, which was the month of the 25th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, and for, you know, someone who grew up when I did and having two older brothers who had college deferments from the draft. And then I was 13 in 1975 when the fall of Saigon and the helicopters off the roof of the embassy.
That was the year I was born.
Well, thanks. And I know Sherry was probably three and silent.
No comment.
Silent Phil wasn't
no
around.
Comment.
Sorry.
But keep that's going. Okay. I'm at peace.
Keep going.
I'm at peace. But I had actually, found a woman, an African-American woman in Northside, or she lived in Northside, and she raised her son there. Her name's Mary Moore, and her son was MIA. And we found her, and Glenn Hartong, so there's a galley of photos in here as well from our colleagues over the years. And Glenn Hartong had done a piercing portrait of Mary with a photo of her son, Greg, who was in a helicopter crash in Vietnam. And we published the story on what would have been Greg's 51st birthday, I believe, in April of 2000. And, you know, I looked at that story, and we had had Mrs. Moore, who is now deceased, write a note to her son. And that's in there, and that ends the military chapter. And there's stories about Tuskegee Airmen and et cetera, in there as well. That was one that, while I could look at it and say, I wish I had written it a little bit differently, the power of the moment really came through. So that's one. The second one, and one that I'm most, there's several, but this one really stays with me was the story of Vince Ward, who is a high school baseball coach in Cincinnati Public Schools. I think he's still at Riverview East. But I'd gotten a tip that led me to Vince in 2013, and he had coached youth baseball for many years, and 19 of his former players had died, many by urban violence, other in auto crashes. And tracking that story through the lens of a baseball team and the many trap doors that are there for young black males growing up, and how Vince is a black man who had lost his own, I believe, stepson in an auto crash, kept pouring himself into these young men to try to get them through the danger zone in, you know, to a safer place in their life. And yet he kept having to speak at all of these funerals. And Amanda Rossman, our colleague, a magnificent photojournalist, there is a beautiful portrait of Vince standing on a ball diamond in Avondale, there at the end of Cleveland Avenue. And we did it on a spring day on a Sunday afternoon, and it just happened to be dark clouds, and Amanda nailed the photo. So it's really beautiful. But I just think that was the kind of story that got me in really, really deep. And again, just really flattered and touched that people would trust me with such stories.
Mark, this is great. Can you, again, you'll be at Joseph Beth.
Thursday, January 23rd, 7 p.m. for a book signing. I want to give a quick shout out to my publisher, University of Cincinnati Press, which is brand new. And
is this their first?
It's among, no, I think we've had, they've had seven or eight prior, mm-hmm. and they did a bicentennial history of the university. I know it's your alma mater, Jason. Mm-hmm. Sherry and I are both from the Mid-American Conference in Miami and Bowling Green. Silent Phil, you're a UC guy, right? So, but he nodded yes. So, yeah, we've got some other things coming up. We just released a book trailer yesterday that's on YouTube, University of Cincinnati Press, Across the Color Line. Really talented young student, Isaac Miller, who's doing the marketing.
Yeah.
So I've been really pleased to work with them and look forward to working with them again. But it's really great. And the last thing I want to say, and I'm talking too much, but I want to say, Jason, you flatter me by telling me that you think highly of my dedication. I'm sitting at a table with two reporters who define that, and I can't think of two other people I've worked with over the years. You know, you and Sherry, that have just taken your work so personally and drop everything you're doing, you know, to make sure the readers are served and that you get your stories correct and you take no shortcuts. And I just want to, you know, say publicly, I miss you guys, but
we miss you.
Grateful for everything we've been able do together. And I appreciate you having me on today.
Well, we miss you. It's interesting. We could sit here and talk about this for a while. Like you know, both of you, when I came to the Inquirer in May of 2012, really embracing, I've learned a lot from you in a lot of ways, are mentors. I know we're not, you know, there's not much age difference between us, but I've looked up to both of you, and you've set an example and a standard in this newsroom and a commitment to excellence that I think probably rivals any newsroom in the country. I want to make sure that we make the book, just give it one more plug. It's available currently. You can buy it on Amazon, barnesandnoble.com,
right,
through the University of Cincinnati Press. So it's totally available right now. Is that correct?
Right. And the last time I checked at Joseph Beth, they had not received the shipment yet. But as of last week, which would have been, you know, second, third week in November, the order started to ship.
Perfect.
So I know some people had ordered it in advance, but it should be at Joseph Beth and, you know, some other local bookstores, if there's any left. Bookstores, I mean. Amazon, UC Press, University of Chicago Press is the distributor. And again, we'll be at Joseph Beth in Norwood on January 23rd.
Mark, thanks so much. Really, really great to have you. And it's great to see you. And I know I miss also miss the gags with you and our friend Dr. Wirt, our data editor. I know he misses it as well. Let's Sherry, now let's jump from Mark and shift gears and bring in we're going back to back with guests today. Silent Phil, as he nods his head yes. He doesn't speak, but he nods. So let's bring in Kurt Reiber from the Free Store Fruit Bank. All right, guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. Special guest time. We'd like to welcome in President and CEO of the Free Store Food Bank, Kurt Reiber. Kurt, thanks for coming by. I know this is a busy season, and appreciate you taking some time to sit down with us and talk about what's going on at the Free Store.
Hey, it's great to be with you both. Obviously, the Free Store has been very supported by the Inquirer, but also by our entire community. And this holiday season is no different. We saw a lot of folks come out and rally around us during our Double Your Dollars Day last week, raised almost $628,000 to really make a difference. And that provides almost 1.9 million meals for our neighbors right here in the tri-state.
What is the Double Your Dollars? Is it an event? Or?
Well, it's a day-long telethon. And what we do there is really – It really kicks off our holiday fundraising efforts, because folks tend to think about the holidays and think about charitable giving towards the end of the year. So it's really a way for us to sort of raise awareness a little bit, but talk about the impact of hunger. When you think about there's one in five of our children that are here in the tri-state area that don't know where their next meal is coming from. One in seven of our neighbors. There's 270,000 folks in the 20 counties served by the Free Store that are living, with very little food in their house. And, mm-hmm. and we want to try to correct that. We hope to do that through our 500 plus pantry partners that are located in each of those 20 counties.
So, I mean, I think that we all tend to think about it this week with the idea of like giving people Thanksgiving meals. Tell us a little bit about that, though, what this week looks like and then what Christmas week looks like.
Well, I call it our Super Bowl, because it really is. When you think about we have the trifecta there. We have our donors coming in and supporting us. We have our just fantastic team and volunteers that are just right there on the front line of hunger each and every day. And then we have our customers that are coming in. Yesterday alone, we saw over 8,600 individuals come through to get a holiday basket of food. It was basically a box of food with the fixings for a Thanksgiving meal, a wonderful turkey, and a bag of produce. And they're taking those home to their families to really experience their own Thanksgiving traditions. So we started off bright and early yesterday morning at 4:30. Now, while we don't open the doors until 8 o'clock, we had some of our customers already lining up at 4:30 in the morning. And because many of them are coming to guests to get food, but then they're heading home to drop off the food and then heading to work. 70% of the families that we serve are working. They're just not making enough money to make ends meet when it comes to the end of the day. So we will see another 8,600 or so individuals come through today. And then we're replicating that food distribution at several of our pantries around the tri-state area, because we know the transportation is a huge issue for the families that we're serving. So we were trying to get the food out to their locations rather than having them have to come downtown to get the food. And we've been doing that for the past 3 years now, and it's been working pretty well for us.
You know, we always think about the holidays of giving, but is there just as much of a need and demand at the Free Store Food Bank in, say, July there is in December?
Yeah, actually, we use the holidays as a way for us to raise awareness about the issue of hunger. But when you think about it, 8 out of 10 students in the 20 counties that we serve are eligible for free and reduced lunches. So when they're out of school, and that could be spring break, that could be summer vacation, here coming up for the holidays, when those students are off school, they're not getting breakfast and they're not getting lunch. So that puts a huge demand on the pantries that we're serving. And we can see an increase of 30-35% during the summer months. And that's really where, that's when we do our little thing we call the Rubber Duck Regatta to really launch that awareness and raise money to provide food for those families, because we know they're struggling.
Now, do you guys also you have a program that goes into the schools? Is that
we do? And that's actually it's a dovetail program because we have a Cincinnati Cooks Culinary Training Program. We've been doing that for almost 20 years mm-hmm. now. But those students, when they're coming in, they're not only getting trained in the culinary arts, but they're producing about 1,000 meals a day for our kids' cafe sites, you know, and we have 24 different locations. And there, what's really neat is that we are partnering, you know, many times the nonprofit sector gets a bad rap for not collaborating, but at our kids' cafe sites, we collaborate with other nonprofits. So Boys and Girls Club, the Salvation Army, Urban League. We also, the Cincinnati Symphony comes in and they perform. They'll have a trio or a quartet come in and perform after school programs for the kids. And then we provide them with a hot meal. So that way, then, whether it's reading comprehension, general tutoring, just mentorships, we try to do that with our partners out there because we can't do it all. It's a community effect.
And I was one, I spent 5 years as a, public relations director at City Gospel Mission. And one of the things I always appreciated about the Free Store Food Bank was it wasn't just a handout. It was about a relationship. It was about, like you said, these partnerships and connecting people who are struggling to services. You mentioned some of those organizations there, but it's about getting people connected with mentors, about getting them other help if, you know, if someone's struggling with substance abuse and the hunger is an issue kind of all tied up into that. It's about helping them. Can you talk about the importance of not or of that it's just not about, you know, handing out food to just anyone and everyone?
It really isn't. When you know, our slogan, our motto, if you will, is food, connection, and hope. The food allows us to have that conversation, allows us to have that, build up that trust for the families that are coming in to seek our services. And then we try to make the connections. Now, some of the services may be some things that we provide, some of the things that we will be doing with collaborative partners. For example, our two workforce training programs, Cincinnati Cooks, as well as Lift the Tri-State, yep. Two areas that are, you know, growing industries within the Tri-State area. When you think about culinary, I mean, let's face it, there are tons of restaurants that are opening up, and those folks need those jobs.
Yeah.
And then you look at the folks in the logistics training area. You know, you've got, you know, a little company called Amazon, I think, has come into town. You've got Wayfair, you have DHL, Kroger, Verst, you name it. We have gotten jobs for folks because we're trying to change the outcomes. We're trying to basically move it to where they can make a difference in their lives by getting good jobs and give them a little bit more dignity and respect because they have strengths that we want to build on.
When you see people come to you with a need, and so, and it's been growing a little bit, maybe the same as last year, but then that's up, right? We're seeing this growing need. Tell us those numbers. But are these new people every year? Are you seeing the same people time after time?
No, actually, and that's one of the misconceptions, if you will, or misperceptions. Everybody thinks that the families that we serve, we see every week, every month. And that's not the case. Actually, most of the time, and we've looked at our Liberty Street Market there and over the Rhine at our Customer Connection Center, the majority of the families come 5 times during the year. They come because a car is broken down, a child has gotten sick, utility bills are out of sight. So they spent the money they would have spent on food on those items. And that's what drives them to our – they're one medical emergency away from being in the food line. We call them economic shocks. And the challenge there is trying to get – our customers, our families that we serve with that economic mobility that will allow them to be self-reliant and self-sufficient. I'm probably one of the only CEOs in town that says, I want to put ourselves out of business. And I know that we'll never be out of business because there's always going to be folks that are going to need our services. But for those families that can attain a job, and what's great about this community right now is that we're starting to embrace and really talk about poverty and hunger as an issue that we should do something about. This isn't like cancer. You don't have to find a cure for it. We know what the cure is. It's getting healthy food to families in need and getting them jobs to stabilize their lives. There's a group that we're working with called Beacon of Hope. These are second chance employers that have basically said, yes, not that they're banning the box, as it's called, but they're giving opportunities for returning citizens that are looking for jobs that have great skills, but they made a bad choice maybe back in their teens or early 20s, and now they're late 30s, early 40s, and they want to contribute to this society, this community. So why don't we embrace them? Why don't we bring them to the work that we're trying to do and accomplish? And that's what the Free Store is all about. We're trying to get those families stabilized in our stability program where we're getting them jobs, we're getting them housing, we're getting them a medical home. We're trying to connect them with the services that some of us take for granted, but they need it because they've not been, you know, in that mix. And this is something that we're trying to do with those employers. And they're just been great partners of ours, hiring our students, allowing them to get a foothold into this growing economy.
How many years have you been with the Free Store?
I've been in this role now for a little over 8 years, and I've been associated with the Free Store for 24 years, or as we like to say it, I've been involved in 24 rubber duck regattas as opposed to the 25 that we just celebrated.
What was it that brought you in and got you involved with the Free Store Food Bank?
Well, couple things. I was one of four boys growing up, and my mom and dad, my dad worked two jobs. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. She was a registered nurse by education, but where we lived, there just wasn't transportation to and from a hospital. So she stayed home with the four boys, which we benefited from. But in order to make ends meet, they would buy what I now found out are called Shiners. And these are canned goods that you can buy at the grocery store that don't have labels on them. Well, when you open them up, we had pet food in those cans. So not that my brothers and I ever went hungry, because we did. My mom and dad made sure that we never went hungry. But that, you know, sort of galvanized some of the, you know, thoughts that I had about people, you know, eating right and being healthy. But then when I turned 50 years old, my kids gave me a book called Halftime. And it's a book by Bob Buford. And in that book, it talks to you about moving from success to significance. Mm-hmm. And I had a great career in the banking industry. I was with Key Bank for almost 30 years. But I saw what was happening in our community. And I saw the value of the time that I was giving to the Free Store as a volunteer. And I said, what if I was able to make this a full-time goal and objective? So fortunately, when my predecessor, John Young, said that he wanted to retire, the board did a national search, and I was the last man standing. But it's just been a labor of love for me for so long. And I'm just blessed by the number of great partners that we have, but our incredible team. We have 120 amazing team members that are on the front line of hunger each and every day. And they're the ones that are doing the heavy lifting. My job's the easiest job. I've got to go out, raise awareness, raise some resources, create some visibility for the organization. But they're the ones that are face-to-face working with our customers, working with our pantry partners out there, and really making an effort to end hunger and stabilize lives.
And Free Stores, it's 100% privately funded, right?
It is. We have some government contracts that are government reimbursements, and we have some USDA commodities that come through. But 85% of all the funds that we get in, and that's about $18 million, comes directly from individuals, family foundations, and some corporate support from the great corporations that we have here in town. But it's really I talk about it's neighbors helping neighbors.
What's the easiest way for someone to give who wants to help?
Well, go to freestorefoodbank.org. They can click on the Volunteer Now button because, let's face it, volunteering. Last year we had over 13,000 volunteers that gave us about 100,000 hours of volunteer service. But if they want to make a donation, that's when they can do it as well. Just hit the Donate Now button. For every dollar that we get in, we can provide up to the equivalent of three meals. And 94% out of all the resources that come into the Free Store go directly to client services. So we try to be good stewards of the resources that we get in, but we also try to make sure that we're making the biggest, you know, creating the biggest bang for the buck, if you will, when we're going out there and trying to make a difference in the lives of the families that we serve.
Is it helpful, too, that when people do bring the food to the local food pantries, is that something?
It really is, Sharon. When you think about it's that community focus. We have, in fact, when I first started here, there was a little girl by the name of Elizabeth, and she brought in, this was right around Thanksgiving time, and her mom pulled her SUV up and said, "Can you help me unload some groceries in the back?" I'm thinking a couple boxes. Well, I opened up the back of the SUV, and it's filled to capacity with food. And this little girl pops her head up from her car seat, and she's smiling. And I said, "Did you do this?" She smiled and said, "Yeah." And she was probably 4 years old. And I'm not sure what kind of allowance a four-year-old gets. Not what I was getting when I was 4 years old, but she brought in about 350 pounds of food. Hmm. And when I asked her, I said, "Elizabeth, what did you decide to buy?" And she says, "I bought what the babies would like." And that's what the canned food drives are all about. I met with some students over at Oak Hills High School earlier last week, and they had a nonprofit fair there. And I had many of the students come up to me and say, "We'd like to do some sort of a food drive." And we know that raises awareness, but it also raises visibility, because so often our community doesn't see the folks that are hungry, because it's not, you don't have a sign on your chest that says, "I'm hungry." So when you have a food drive, it allows people to do something that's tangible and relatable, and because they can say, "I like this kind of food. I want to be able to share that with others." And that's what I try to tell people. I said, "Don't clean out your pantries."
Yeah.
You know, we've got enough three bean salad.
Yeah.
But what I really want people to do is, when you're going to the store, buy two of what you like. So often the families that come to me and ask me about, "What would our families like to eat?" I said, "Well, what do your families like to eat?"
So macaroni and cheese and SpaghettiOs.
Oh, macaroni and cheese and SpaghettiOs. Those are the sweet spot. When you think about it, peanut butter and jelly, you know, cereal, canned soups. I mean, chilies on days like today, when you have a little nip in the air out there, those are the things that our families just really relish. And that's what we're doing for our Thanksgiving food distribution. And that's what we'll do for our December food distribution as well. We are doing, you know, we're providing them with the makings of a holiday meal, because the holidays is something where everybody has their own traditions, and the families that we serve are not any different than any of us. They have those family traditions as well. So they know what to expect, how to bring everybody around, because they understand the food connection and hope.
What's the number one most popular food item that people like, or that is there? Do people request things, or is it?
Yeah, most of our pantries are set up as choice pantries, and what I mean by that, it's just like you're going into a supermarket and you're shopping for your family. So we give them the dignity and respect that they deserve when they come into our pantries, so they can shop for what they like. But we make. If you need a gluten-free diet, we have some folks that come in that are, you know, experiencing homelessness. So we have bags of food that they can take with them, that they can, you know, they can cook over a camp stove or a fire. So I can't tell you that there's a specific item that folks would like, but if you think about we talked about it, mac and cheese, you know, the comfort foods that are out there, the soups, the canned meats, the tunas, the chickens, those sorts of things are just wonderful for the families that we're serving. And the old staple of peanut butter and jelly, I mean, I grew up on it as a little kid, and I continue to eat those all the time today as well. So the families that we serve love that kind of thing.
Do you also take things like shampoo and toothbrushes and toothpaste?
Yeah, when you think about one thing that people don't understand, SNAP benefits, or you know what they used to be called, as food stamps, you can't use those to buy personal hygiene products. So toothpaste, toothbrushes, deodorants, you know, feminine hygiene products, all those things that we get in. We started a program with Children's Hospital, about 9 years ago now, called KIND, Keeping Infants Nourished and Developing. We found that there were mothers that were that were watering down the formula or skipping meals, so the babies weren't getting that nutrition that they need over the first 12 months of their life. So we were providing them with the formula, and we also gave them some diapers. Somehow those two things go together. But the beauty part about what we saw was that these mothers started feeding and these babies were thriving. And that's what we want to see, is we want to see those babies, you know, grow up, because we basically talk about a hungry child can't learn and an uneducated adult can't earn. And that's the paradigm we're trying to shift here.
Well, I think to me, like, you know, the free store is it really shows how generous Greater Cincinnati is. I mean, it's one of those, you know, shining beacons on the hill, organizations that is doing right by our community, is doing right by the donations and the money that you get in. And it also shows how generous this community is. And I think that sometimes we can get caught up in, you know, rich people, what they do with their money and all that. But you think about the free store, and it to me, it shows how generous this.
It really does, Jason. When you think about the impact that this community has had on the free store, when we started back in 1971, Frank Gerson, our founder, he was working on the incinerator line for the city of Cincinnati, and he found things that shouldn't be burned. You know, they were household items, and he would pull them off, and he got the approval from a supervisor to take them home to his one-bedroom apartment in Clifton Heights. And then his wife, Connie, said, "Frank, you got to get rid of this stuff." So the landlord said that you could use the third floor. So at 124 Lyon Street is where the free store was born.
And right up by UC.
Yeah. And it was just up on the top of the third floor. And Frank had regular business hours. So from 10 o'clock to 2 o'clock, we would have the doors open, and folks would come up and drop off things they didn't need or pick up things they did need. And that's really the impetus. I mean, that vision that Frank Gerson had to help out his fellow human being here in town has really been the hallmark of what the free store is all about, and really what this community has embraced about the free store food bank. And that's something that, you know, that's a trust that we hold for this entire community.
And now, how many folks a year come through the door that you're helping?
We serve about 270,000 individuals. Wow. Throughout the 20 county service area. We go from, and this is a lot not known about the free store. You know, someone thinks, well, we're just downtown Cincinnati or Hamilton County. But we go from Wilmington, Ohio, down to Owenton, Kentucky, so about 120 miles north to south. And then we go from Aurora, Indiana, over to Portsmouth, Ohio, so about 150 miles east to west. And in those 20 counties, we have 500-plus pantry partners that are, you know, probably 80% of them are faith-based. Mm-hmm. But they're serving more than just their congregations. They're serving their entire community. And that's where I talk about the money and resources that we get in go directly to helping the neighbors that are in need right there in the community. And that's something that I think is just wonderful to see, the outpouring of support that we've received over the years. Last year, I was, you know, mentioning earlier that we had a drop-off in donations in December because of the new tax laws. Mm-hmm. So there was about 4,000 donors that didn't have to itemize anymore. So that meant that we had a reduction in, you know, revenue, you know, giving of about $1 million. Now, fortunately, we had a couple of very generous donors that stepped up. One of them was a longtime donor of ours and wrote us a check for $1 million, closing that gap. But they closed that gap for us because of the work that we do and the respect and dignity that we give to the families that we're serving. And that was what was important to them, because we're always trying to be good stewards of the resources we get in. And it's not just the big dollar gifts. Last year, there was one of our customers that came through the line waiting for, this is Christmas time. And she gave me a card, and she said she saw me on TV that morning. And she says, "Don't read it now, but it'll make a difference for you." Mm. What I had said earlier in the morning, because someone was asking me about, you know, the big gifts, and I said, "I'll never turn away a big gift, But I said, even a single dollar will allow us to provide three meals, the equivalent of three meals to families here in need. Well, in the card from one of our customers was just basically a simple statement. It said, thank you for all that you do for us and our entire community. And there was a single dollar in the card. And she said, I know this will make a difference.
Yeah.
That's what this community is all about.
And you know, I'm sure that you have, you're giving me goosebumps because I can remember at City Got, like, there would be folks who would send in, you know, a couple of dimes, you know, pocket change in an envelope. And it wasn't, they would send it like, hey, I want this, that's what they had. And they would try to make a difference, you know, whatever meal cost is, whatever, 29 cents a meal or something. And they would send in, you know, two quarters or something, and they meant it.
I've seen this time and time again when we write stories, like poverty seems just like an overwhelming problem, but people feel like they can do a little bit.
You're right. And when you think about it, as I said, you know, people say, how do you tackle hunger? How do you deal with poverty? And the way you deal with it is just one person, one family at a time. They always talk about how to eat an elephant, one bite at a time. And that's really what you're focused in on. What keeps us going are the stories that you talk about. There was a third grade teacher in Pendleton, Kentucky, and she was giving out the Power Packs, our weekend feeding program for kids.
Yeah.
And one of her third grade boys was pulling together all the trays from his buddy's lunchroom on this Friday. And he proceeded to take off his socks and shoes and was scooping the leftover mashed potatoes from his friend's plates into his socks. Mm. And his teacher came up and said, Billy, what are you doing? And he was embarrassed, as you might imagine. He says, they weren't going to eat this. She goes, but no, why are you doing it? And she said, I'm doing it because I bring home a Power Pack, but I don't have enough food to share with my brother and sister. So this is a way for me to help make that difference. There was another little boy that just sent us an email, and he said that his mom and dad had to sell his toys to pay for rent. But he was so excited about the fact that he was going to be getting a Power Pack every Friday this school year, because the kids understand it and they know the challenges they experience, but they know that this community is going to rally behind them and change the outcomes and make a difference in their lives so they don't have to deal with hunger in the future.
Thank Kurt. We're all sitting here, if we had video, you could see that we all are sitting here with tears in our eyes. And thanks for everything that you do. Thanks for everything the Free Store Food Bank does. And can you share again where folks can donate and get involved?
Absolutely. And we appreciate the opportunity to showcase what we're doing because it does make a difference. Folks can go and learn more at freestorefoodbank.org. They can go there and learn about the volunteer opportunities, the various programs. If they need help, they can go to freestorefoodbank.org and find out where there's a pantry closest to them. We have a number of partners that are out there. They're helping us, you know, end hunger and stabilize lives. And every donation makes a difference. Every dollar makes a difference. And this community has been just great champions of our work. And we're blessed to be here.
Thank you, Kurt.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Mark Kernute, our former colleague, now Miami University instructor, and author of the new book, Across the Color Line. And also Kurt Reiber from the Free Store Food Bank. Wow, Sherry, we were all sitting there almost nearly speechless there at the end. And
It's hard to think about people going hungry.
It is. And, you know, Kurt talked about this being a time of awareness, and that's right. And the key thing, and I know what he's generally know what he's going through right now, is that, you know, this is that awareness time, but it doesn't end, or it doesn't, the donation shouldn't end, and the work doesn't end just at Thanksgiving and Christmas. It's a year-round work and a year-round struggle for so many people in our area.
I mean, he said two things that really struck me of things that are really, you know, part of the conversation right now in this city. It's just these emergency services, not people who need it every week. I mean, it reminded me of the eviction prevention program. Greg Landsman was on here talking about it a couple weeks ago, where that's just emergency assistance when you need it. And it's not every month. It's like money, part of it, there's a lot of pieces to it, but part of it is like money to help people just bridge that first gap if they can't stay in their home. And that sounds like what he's talking about with the food too, where there's these other expenses and you just need this temporary, you know, help. And then he also talked about reentry a little bit kind of in passing, but we really saw that come out of City Hall too, the idea of like expungements for these low-level marijuana cases. That was a big thing this year in the city because these people can't get jobs. And I went over to the Hamilton County Public Defender's Office expungement clinic. They do it once a month. And just hearing those people's stories, and they even weren't all in the story because some people didn't really want to discuss it. But hearing those stories, like that they just can't get a better job because, you know, they have a marijuana ticket from 20 years ago. You're like, that's just so stunning to me.
It's ridiculous.
And so I just, these things are all part of the conversation of like, you know, bettering our community. And that's how we're going to just reduce these really high poverty numbers with, you know, these different kind of programs here and there to help stabilize people.
And I'm even, you know, as we're sitting here talking, I'm thinking back to our last week's episode with Judge Fanon Rucker running for prosecutor, when he shared the story about the young man who, you know, came before him and was really struggling and then came back 60 days later and had a job and was dressed really well and was really a completely different person. And so when you think about, you know, these services and, you know, a volunteering opportunity or a donation, whether it's a dollar or $1 million, every little, I know it sounds like such a cliche, but, you know, there are so many people out there who are just need a little nudge and some love and a relationship to help them get on the right track. Sometimes that's a longer term investment. And sometimes, you know, that can be just a little nudge of a meal or, you know, you get into a program and in a month or so, things can change. And so I really encourage, encourage folks to do your homework, whether you want to donate to the Free Store Food Bank or City Gospel Mission or the Shelter House or Bethany, you know, any of these other organizations, do your homework on those places, and they're always looking for people's skills and talents and obviously treasure. And like I said, they're, you know, he shared the story too about you know, they were $1 million short. Was that last year? And someone steps up and gives $1 million. Whoever that someone is.
I tried to pry the name out of him, and I do. You know what? This happens more. Then, you know, this is not the kind of thing that you read about. Yep. I try to pry that name out of him. You hear about these donations and then the people who are giving them, they don't want their name out there. And so it's just this unknown giving from, you know, wealthy people in this community that people don't always do things for recognition.
That's exactly right. I've always said this, and having lived in, I guess, 4 or 5 different places in what, 3 or 4 different states. 4 different states, to be a matter of fact, and having worked in journalism and both in the PR side and in the social service agency realm, I will say this again. I've said it before. Greater Cincinnati, there are so many generous people here who don't want the credit. And again, it goes from that elderly lady out in Butler County who sends in two dimes to, you know, the people that we always, you know, the folks that we know their names, the Lindner family and the Farmer family, you know. And so somebody, you can make a difference, folks. What doesn't matter how much money you have, whatever you do, you have a gift of something to give. And so certainly this is the time of year where that awareness comes about. And anyway, let's shift. I know this was a serious episode, and well, let's shift. I do want to ask you something fun. I noticed on Facebook over the weekend, Sherry, that
yes.
You had photos of you at yoga. You were doing yoga with your friend Julie.
I was, yes.
And but there was one photo where there was a goat standing on your back.
Oh my god!
Literally a goat, like a farm animal goat.
You know, I'm
not the greatest of all time goat, but the actual animal goat.
I love the goats.
What the hell was that all about?
This is a thing. It's you know, first of all, I'm like team cycle bar, and I like to spin, but Julie's like, I heard about, you know, this really fun thing, and various gyms do it. I happen to do it at Living Fitness on Bridgetown Road over the weekend. It's goat yoga.
And not goat rodeo, not, but goat yoga.
Yeah. And in which, you know, there's like a regular yoga class. I mean, very little yoga was getting done. It's called Yo Goat Cincinnati. It's just these lovely women, and they bring the goats. And let me think about this. Whether four goats or six goats. And they came and they hung out with us during yoga. And they're the most – I did it because I thought it would be funny. But honestly, I left there. They're so cuddly and sweet. I know that people are like they're farm animals, but they seemed more like pets. I mean, they were wearing Christmas sweaters. They were all dressed up.
And these were kind of mini goats too, right? They were smaller.
There were regular goats and baby goats. Oh my God. You didn't even want to put the baby goats down. Like I had one of them fall asleep in my arms. Again, not doing the yoga part. And they were very sweet. And I left there with such a sense of peace just from the cuddles.
So did the goats didn't try to eat the mat or your shoes or anything like that?
The goats did try and do that.
Okay. Those things will eat, because my aunt and uncle used to have a goat, and those things, I'm telling you, they will eat any. They'll eat trash, whatever's in front of them, they will eat it.
They were trying to do that, and they also, goats do pee and poop.
So wait, what's the okay, so is there some kind of philosophy with the goats? Is that it?
It is the idea of the calming. It's for the cuteness factor, of course, but it is which is what yoga is about, right? You leave there with a sense of peace and the calming, and it helps with it. It really did. It put me in that kind of mood for the whole rest of the day.
So when you were doing like the thing where you were on all fours, was the goat supposed to be on your back, or did it just
No, that's the thing with goat yoga and putting them, and because then you're like stable and you're doing the position in the correct way, which I never do. I'm not much of a yoga person. But if you're able to have the goat on your back, then you were doing it the right way.
Were you worried about the goat knowing its business on your back?
I was not. Okay. If it happened, it happened.
Has that happened to anyone, or do they not usually?
I did not ask that question.
Okay.
So, yes, that was of all the things that was just a unique experience. It was just more than I thought that it was going to be. I did it for the cute factor, but I loved it.
Goat yoga, folks. It is a real thing. Silent Phil, did you know goat yoga was a real thing?
I did, actually.
Oh, he speaks.
They do do it at Rheingeist.
Do they?
Yeah, a couple weekends.
We got anything else? Phil? Uh-oh, Phil's got something to say.
What are you all thankful for? It being Thanksgiving this week.
It's a good question.
That is a good question. Do you go around the table and say what you're thankful for? We do that.
Yeah, we usually do that. I guess I'm going to have to come up with something.
You know, it's we're recording on Tuesday. Not necessarily in Thanksgiving mode yet. I'm thankful that my sister-in-law is doing all of the Thanksgiving dinner and we're going to her house.
What am I thankful for, Phil? I am thankful for. This is just the first thing that came to mind. I'm I'm being dead honest. Like, I'm thankful for this newsroom and the people in it are friends, and we've been through a lot, and we're covering some tough stories right now. And I don't, you know, the outside world doesn't see how some things out there that affect us internally, but we're human, and to see just people, you know, pull themselves up every day and get out there and cover Cincinnati, and I am incredibly thankful for that. So,
me too. That crossed my mind. I didn't say it out loud, but it did cross my mind. Read a lot about journalism now. It's a lot in the news about it, and I'm grateful that we have this.
Absolutely. Well, anyway, I hope everyone who is listening, thank you. I'm thankful for you guys too. Like, certainly. But I hope that, you know, you guys have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and that there are some things you're able to take, you know, a day or two or a weekend here to reflect on this year and reflect on what you're thankful for. And certainly we will just wish you a very happy Thanksgiving, and we will be back next week.